Good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Public health experts today pay attention to social media to better understand the effects of this COVID-19 pandemic. But that snapshot online shows some groups are overrepresented on social media, and that skews our understanding of where the new coronavirus is spreading and how people are coping with it. That's our focus this hour of the morning show, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you talking about COVID-19 on Facebook or on Twitter? How often do you log on, and what are you and your friends or followers saying about it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Our guest is Celeste Campos Castillo. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She recently published a journal article on racial and ethnic digital divides in posting COVID-19 content related on social media. Celeste, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
People are turning to their phones, tablets, to computers to find information during this pandemic. Where do people usually go to find info about COVID-19?
Well, they turn to Google to search for information. As far as social media platforms go, they're turning to Reddit. Reddit has started a subreddit dedicated to the coronavirus. They're also turning to platforms such as Twitter and Instagram, and this is all going to be contingent on the age of the individual. So older folks will go to Facebook, middle-aged folks will go to Facebook as well as Twitter, and the younger folks and adolescents will turn to Instagram as well as Snapchat.
Okay, so if I feel like I'm maybe somewhere in the middle with which platforms I'm using, that actually fits right exactly with age, that older people are using different technologies than the younger people are.
Correct.
And what kind, then, of conversations are social media users having with friends or with followers?
Well, all different kinds related to the virus and the broader pandemic that's going on. And so, these are things that used to happen pre-pandemic. People used to turn to social media to talk about mundane everyday things. Well, during the pandemic, the mundane everyday things are staying at home, social distancing. And so there's a hashtag that's emerged, hashtag social distancing, to denote that you're doing what you've been doing every day for quite some time now during the pandemic. You're staying home. In addition, just like before the pandemic, whenever out of the ordinary things happen to us, we'll turn to social media. Out of the ordinary things now are feeling sick and being concerned that you might have the virus or that people around you might have contracted the virus. And so turning to social media to talk about the virus itself, potential symptoms that we might be experiencing. And in addition to that, other things that are going on during the pandemic that are affecting all kinds of people, like losing their job, getting furloughed, receiving a pay cut, not being able to see a friend or family member, the concert that got canceled that you were looking forward to for months that you spent, you saved money for and got canceled, the school getting shut down. It's people turning to social media to express what they're feeling and connect with others.
I think many people recognize that despite privacy settings, the things that we post on social media platforms are public. I mean, we're speaking in a public arena, and yet we might not realize just how much analysis can happen with that data. So what are the potential benefits here from analyzing what people are saying and how they're talking about it?
Well, the potential benefits are that public health researchers can use this information, these public posts, to track in real time things like symptoms, things like psychological effects, being able to track maybe who is or is not social distancing, not specific individuals here. We're talking about at the aggregate level here. Public health researchers aren't trying to identify a very specific person and trying to get them in trouble or anything like that. They're just trying to keep track of where mitigation strategies are working, where they're not, potential public sentiment toward policies, potential psychological effects that maybe they didn't think about. And this can happen rapidly, at least more rapidly than trying to field a survey and analyze the results of that survey.
Because people are volunteering this information already out in the open, you're not having to track them down and try to convince them to take time to answer your survey?
Correct.
We're discussing how public health experts use social media to track the effects of COVID-19 with Celeste Campos-Casillo. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Did you start using social media after the pandemic began? What do you notice your friends or people you follow are posting regarding the crisis? What kinds of conversations are you having there? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us a message at ideas@wpr.org. Celeste, how do public health surveillance experts actually track the effects of the virus then for everyday people online?
Well, what they'll do is that they'll turn to social media platforms like Twitter. So some social media platforms this is easier to do than others. So it's easier to do on Twitter and Reddit. You can directly connect to the platform. And what you'll do is that you'll do a search for search terms or hashtags. And so part of the initial step is figuring out what are the words that people are using, that everyday people are using. And so, for example, if you're looking for something related to the virus, you might enter in COVID-19. But the problem is that everyday people may not necessarily use the word COVID-19 to refer to the virus. So you do kind of need to do a little bit of your own research, either talking to everyday individuals or sort of browsing around these different platforms to get a sense of what are the specific words or phrases that people are using. And so instead of using COVID-19, everyday people might be just saying COVID or coronavirus or coronavirus in two words. Or corona. And so these are search terms that you would enter into the platform to be able to identify posts. If we're talking about Twitter, we're talking about tweets, posts, publicly available posts that you can then download in the hundreds, thousands, millions, and then begin to analyze.
Wow. What social media platforms are researchers focusing on?
Right now in the U.S., it would be primarily Twitter.
Sure. So the other ones people are sharing things or posting things. Why Twitter versus Facebook or Instagram?
Just because it's easier to access the information, the publicly available posts for Twitter, as opposed to Facebook or Instagram, which is owned by Facebook.
Gotcha. So some of it is about access for researchers, too.
Correct.
We're talking with Celeste Campos-Castillo about social media. We're talking about how people with different backgrounds use it differently or more frequently to talk about public health crisis. And we're talking about how researchers get that information, look at it, and identify what's going on. So we're talking about some of the trends that we're seeing and that researchers, including Celeste, are picking up on. You can call 800-642-1234 with your questions about how researchers might be viewing social media posts about COVID-19. Do you follow public health organizations and researchers? Where do you go to get your information when something's on your mind? Maybe you are using social media to talk about COVID-19 or just watch what's happening with the new coronavirus. What are the conversations you're part of like? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. When health experts started pleading with us to keep our distance, some people took to working remotely. Others leave the house to go to their jobs at stores, offices, clinics, and call centers. And still, we're trying to limit our face-to-face interactions with other people. Many of us turn to screens. We're exploring what we can learn about our digital behavior and what we really can't this hour of the morning show. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. How do you stay informed about how health officials are dealing with the pandemic in your area? Have you talked about it on social media? What are you seeing? 800-642-1234 or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Celeste Campos Castillo is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and does research in many of these areas. How open are social media users about discussing the financial effects of this pandemic, specifically on their lives? Are we talking about money?
Yes, individuals are talking about money. They're talking about their salaries or wages getting cut. They're talking about the rent and the mortgage payment that they won't be able to make for a current month. They're talking about the rising costs of groceries and how difficult it is to pay for groceries. Money is definitely a big topic.
And that strikes me a little bit because I think that's one of the things that I'm not as comfortable talking about on social media. And you're saying people are just talking about this. They're just telling people about these struggles that they're enduring. What might social media users leave out of their posts or keep private on the flip side of that?
Well, it's interesting because usually finances are definitely something that people would keep private. But during the pandemic, this is an experience that everybody is having. Similarly, other issues that people would usually keep private, such as their mental health, their personal psychological struggles, losing a family member, these are issues that people would usually keep private. But on social media, during the pandemic, as other individuals, other social media users in their networks are sharing this information, it now starts to become okay, at least it starts to seem okay, more appropriate to share in this experience with other people, to commiserate, to find social support for this common experience.
And then I assume more honesty in these avenues helps researchers better understand what's really going on in people's lives.
Yes.
The pandemic also highlighted many pre-existing disparities that already exist, specifically this digital divide. What does that look like?
So the digital divide cuts across several different demographics. The ones that I study have to do with age. So older adults, individuals who are 65 and older, especially who are 80 and older, are less likely to have access to the Internet. If they do have access to the Internet, they're also less likely than the younger individuals to use it for social media, to search for information. The other demographic group that I'll look at is racial and ethnic minorities. Specifically Black and Latinx Americans who are less likely to have access to the Internet, especially broadband, high-speed Internet, and when they do, less likely to use it for things like social media.
We know that racial and ethnic minority groups are affected disproportionately by the pandemic, and they experience a higher risk of actually getting and suffering from COVID-19. How can we think about that and the digital divide at the same time?
So the digital divide, the racial and ethnic digital divide that I just described that predates the pandemic, in many ways it got worse during the pandemic, but in other ways it got better. Some of the ways that it got better, that those divides, those disparities narrowed, is when you think about all the different programs and nonprofit organizations that came together to offer high-speed internet access and computer devices and mobile devices. And so, for example, the FCC encouraged several internet providers to offer free or low-cost high-speed internet to individuals. And so there were a couple of different programs put in place to help address and narrow these racial and ethnic digital divides. But at the same time, though, there were other changes that exacerbated these divides. If people were losing their job and their job was their only access to a computer or only access to high-speed internet, they've now lost that access. And Black and Latinx Americans were much more likely to have lost their job during the pandemic. Schools closing, libraries closing. For many individuals, that might be the only source of a computer or access to high-speed internet.
Celeste Campos-Castillo studies how social media, electronic health records, and patient portals are used by people. And you can give us a call if you have questions about how researchers are looking at information that we're posting online and trying to better understand what's happening with COVID-19. The number is 800-642-1234. Think about how often you log on to Facebook or Twitter. What are your friends saying about the new coronavirus? 800-642-1234. Celeste, what programs have you seen that have really further helped people in different communities? I know you talked about increasing internet access, but are there programs that researchers have been able to notice on social media that seem to be really helping marginalized people?
Yeah, so the schools are coming through for families who didn't have a mobile device or a computer device. They're sending kids, students homes with a mobile device, a tablet, even just to be able to access the virtual learning experience from home. There's also school buses that are driving around neighborhoods to offer a Wi-Fi hotspot for families who otherwise wouldn't have access to high-speed internet. There's more broadly beyond just the school environment. There's been these mobile service providers who have been offering larger data plans for individuals and not charging them for going over their data caps for a particular month.
Well, that certainly helps. I mean, it can help families, but especially young kids. Let's go to the other side of the age range. Older adults are less likely to use social media, but they're also indicated as a high-risk population for suffering more from this virus. What insights have you gained from looking at the age of social media users?
Sure. So during the pandemic, I've been looking at the gender divide and who is posting on social media content related to COVID-19, as well as searching for information related to the virus. And usually across different age groups, but this also appears among older adults, usually it's men who search for information on the internet. Or maybe there aren't any gender differences in terms of who is likely to search for information on the internet. But one of the things that I found in a recent publication that will be coming out here in the Journals of Gerontology is that among older adults who are between 50 and 65, women are the most likely to search for information on COVID-19. And while it's difficult to say exactly what they're searching for or why they're searching for information on COVID-19, there's other data that shows that women between ages of 50 and 65 are the most likely out of all adults to be caring for an older adult, someone who is 65 and older. And so it's possible that women between 60 and 65 are searching for information to help take care of their older family member.
You talked about how, although this virus seems to affect men more, women are searching more, and that's one of the reasons. But how should we think about the fact that the data online does not necessarily align with how positive test rates are going?
Well, it identifies potential gaps, potential needs. And so men are much more likely to be at risk for contracting the virus from having serious complications. And if they're less likely to use the internet, if they're less likely to use social media, for example, then there is potentially a need there, a necessity to intervene. And other public health researchers have talked about leveraging the internet to help older adults during this time. not just older adults who may be suffering from the virus, but the older adults who are isolated to try to protect themselves from their families. Accessing social media could be a means to making them feel less isolated and more socially connected to others. Mm-hmm. And if men, for example, are less likely to use social media, or at least use the internet for social needs, then that means that there's a need to create an intervention tailored for older men.
We're talking with Celeste Campos Castillo about social media and the new coronavirus. She studies how social media, electronic health records, and patient portals are used by patients and healthcare providers. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you had a doctor's appointment? Did you go in person or did you embrace the virtual side of care? How does that work for you? 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. Thanks for being here now. Join us tonight at 8 for live NPR coverage of the Republican National Convention. We're bringing you the mix of live and virtual events planned as delegates are expected to confirm Donald Trump as their party's candidate for president. That's tonight through Thursday night, starting at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. And of course, online, just visit WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about technology. Health officials are relying on it while dealing with COVID-19. They're using social media to help track the virus, and they're also delivering healthcare over the internet. Our guest studies how patients and providers use communication technologies related to their health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's the primary way you connect with your doctor? How often do you communicate over email, or do you pick up the phone and call? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We've got Dave from Milwaukee ready to join the conversation. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I'm kind of an old timer. I'm an interstate truck driver, and I mostly use the phone. But, you know, with this COVID thing, I'm 65, and they say, well, people over 60 are very susceptible to it. But I think I had that back in February. And the deal is, when you're an interstate truck driver and you get sick in the truck, you're kind of stuck in the truck. And in Ohio, I was pretty damn sick, and I had to actually sit for a day. But when I describe my symptoms to other truck drivers that have been out here, they're like, oh, yeah, I had that. I had that. This is back in February. January, but that when I've been out here ever since. I mean, but I haven't had any COVID. The only thing I have is like a little tightness in the back of my throat that won't go away. And when I describe this to other truckers, they say, yeah, I got the same thing. And like this occasional cough comes once in a while, but you know, we don't get sick, but you got that tightness in the back of your throat all the time now. And you know, I use, you know, whenever I go into a warehouse or anywhere I'm around people, I always wear a mask, wash my hands, kind of stay away from people. Yeah. And I've been all right so far. But that's kind of, you know, just talking to other truckers. I mean, we're kind of out here, you know, public facilities, public showers. I mean, you know, it's just sort of a...
Yeah, it's hard to stay home when you're a cross-country trucker, Dave. I'm sorry to hear that you haven't been well, but thanks for sharing your story. Celeste Campos Castillos, Dave is talking about actually talking with other people, you know, having those conversations. Are we seeing similar conversations on social media with people saying, you know, I wasn't tested, I didn't know this was a thing back then, but I think I got sick?
Yes, we're definitely seeing that on social media. I mean, any time that something that we're uncertain about happens to us, I mean, especially right now during the pandemic, any sniffle, any cough, any feeling in the back of the throat, as he was saying, that just seems off. I mean, anytime something where we're not sure about what's going on with us, I mean, it's natural for us to turn to others and get their feedback on what they may be experiencing and what they think might be going on with us. And right now during the pandemic, because of social distancing, rather than being able to turn to the person right next to you, there's individuals who are isolated from others. And so the only way that they have access to other people's opinions to help make sense of this uncertain situation is to turn to social media.
Dave, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. There's room for you if you have a story to share or a question for our guest. Celeste Campos-Castillo studies disparities in patient-physician interaction and also how health information technologies may narrow or exacerbate those disparities. Let's talk about telehealth, because if we're actively sick, we might, you know, turn to a physician. We're seeing more therapists, more doctors, other health providers offering online appointments as an option to patients. How comfortable do patients seem to be with this option based on your research?
It varies based on what it is that the patient is experiencing, because telehealth is so new. I mean, before the pandemic, very few patients were using it. Very few providers were offering telehealth options. And so it was a brand new option for many individuals. And there are patients who, during the pandemic, if they had an appointment or were feeling sick or were worried about something, they've been delaying their visit to a healthcare provider, their in-person visit to a healthcare provider, and saying no to a telehealth option if they can't. But for the individuals who have a chronic condition, who need follow-up care, or who may have COVID-19 symptoms, the only other option that they have is to go through a telehealth visit.
And yet we hear about patient portals, these online tools where you can connect with doctors, where you can access your test results in real time or schedule appointments or see your medical records. We hail these opportunities as something that's good for everybody that we should just be able to access and go for. And your research is showing the fact that there's access doesn't mean people are going to use these services?
Correct. I mean, the percentage of the population of U.S. adults who have used this type of service before the pandemic, depending on the specific technology, like telehealth, like a patient portal, like sending an email, ranges anywhere from 20 to 30% of the population. And this is, you know, pre-pandemic, where especially like technology like patient portals, there are many more providers that are offering a patient portal this year than they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And there was many incentives for providers to adopt these technologies and offer them to their patients and encourage their patients to use them. And yet, despite that, like I said, I mean, only 20 to 30% of the U.S. adult population has used any one of these technologies. And there are several different reasons for why that percentage is so low. The first one is something that we were talking about earlier, digital divide. Second is privacy and security concerns. And the third one is that people just prefer to see their healthcare provider in person.
Talk more about privacy concerns. What would people be worried about happening with an online portal or a visit over the internet?
Well, first, they're worried about something that people are worried about regardless of the technology, like, for example, social media, any type of technology that is storing our personal information on a server, and that's that it could get hacked. There's a risk of identity theft that people are thinking about now more so than they were 10 or 15 years ago. Second, there may be information there that they don't want specific people within their social networks to know about. For example, they might have a cancer scare, and maybe they're not ready yet to disclose that information to a family member or a friend. They could be very close to this friend or family member, but they're just not yet ready to disclose to these people that they might have cancer, that they do have some kind of cancer.
Celeste Campos-Castillo studies how social media, how electronic health records, and how patient portals are used both by patients and by healthcare providers. We are live and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you schedule appointments with your doctor via video conference or over the phone? Do you log into a patient portal, or have you decided that is not for you? You're going to call the office and schedule an in-person appointment. Why do you make those decisions about your health care? Is it an issue with your internet access, or is it a comfort level? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to have a conversation or ask your question of our guest here this morning on the Ideas Network. We can circle back, Celeste, to two issues that we have been talking about this conversation, age and race. Again, what does telehealth look like for Black adults or Latinx adults when it comes to how likely they are to use this?
Well, during the pandemic, there's been researchers across the country who have been collecting the data to make sure that there aren't any racial and ethnic disparities. Because anytime that a new technology gets rolled out, as I was saying before the pandemic, many providers weren't offering these options. But now, because of the pandemic, they had to quickly adopt this new technology. And so anytime that there's a new technology that's rolled out or new policies to encourage use of this technology, as was done across several payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and private payers, they changed policies to facilitate use of telehealth. Anytime there's swift, rapid change like this, there's this concern that there will be disparities along demographics like racial and ethnic minority status. And so researchers across the country have been tracking these trends and making sure that there aren't any disparities. And as of right now, it's a mixed bag. There's some researchers that have found no differences by race and ethnicity with regards to whether or not someone is using a telehealth visit during the pandemic. There's studies that show that racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to use telehealth than whites. And there's researchers like myself and at least one other researcher that have found that racial and ethnic minorities are more likely than whites to use telehealth during the pandemic.
So certainly on the early end of getting that empirical data to figure out what are we actually dealing with here during a pandemic, as opposed to how telehealth was used before we had such issues with COVID-19 and encouraging people to try to keep their distance if possible. We're talking with Celeste Campos Castillo, who works at UW Milwaukee in the sociology department. And we are discussing how the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted some of the disparities already in our nation, especially when it comes to socioeconomic classes, racial and ethnic groups, age. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Right now we're talking about online medicine and whether that's for you. You can let us know how you think about that and whether you're comfortable with virtual visits. Email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're breaking down data and busting assumptions as we talk with Celeste Campos Castillo. She studies how social media and healthcare intersect, and her research reveals who's taking to the internet to talk about COVID-19 and who's most affected by the new coronavirus. And we have Kathy in Madison, who's ready to join the conversation. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I treat outpatient adults in the Madison area. I work for a large hospital organization, and our policy is that when a patient is referred for an evaluation, they have to do the evaluation in person. However, any additional visits are up to the patient if they want to do virtual visits or if they want to have those visits in person. And one of the, it's 50-50. I mean, some people really like the virtual visits and some patients like the face-to-face. And it you know, depends on their situation. If a patient is not an English speaker, they cannot do virtual visits because I need an interpreter. We've been using language lines rather than in-person interpreters. And also the broadband issue is such an obstacle for any patients wanting to do online visits. In I work outside Madison, and I'm seeing patients, you know, 20, 30 miles outside Madison, and they don't have the internet capability to just get a video feed. So it can work, and it keeps patients safe. Our patients who are a little more fragile that have, you know, complicating conditions, obviously, you know, they have, you know, they do have a medical history because they are getting they're getting treatment.
Right.
But it's the broadband is a huge issue. And, you know, patients, like I said, who are not English speakers, that makes it very difficult for them.
Kathy, thank you so much for raising that issue. Celeste, Kathy saying broadband is a real challenge if you want to deliver adequate medical care virtually.
Yes, I mean, and there have been providers who have tried to address this by sharing mobile devices among their patients. So they'll have like 5 or 6 tablets that they have there on stock, and they'll take it to their patients' home and then collect it back, and then, of course, quarantine the device. But 5 or 6 devices is not going to be enough to reach the individuals who don't have these types of devices to do a video visit. And so they've been trying other types of telehealth services that don't require broadband services. So at least during the pandemic, telehealth has taken on a meaning of video only. But technically, a definition for telehealth encompasses a broad range of forms of electronic communication between a patient and provider. It includes things like regular telephone. It includes things like email. It includes things like text messaging. And so providers have been trying to use some of these other services to reach the individuals who don't have access to high-speed internet like broadband. But in the case of an area like speech and language, as Kathy was saying, telephone visit just isn't going to cut it for that initial visit. Or in the case of, I've been talking to providers who do cognitive assessments of older adults, and that's very hard to do over the phone. Or they try to get a sense of what's going on in the home environment of an older adult. Again, that's going to be very hard to do over the telephone. And so providers have been good at coming up with new ways to reach out to their patients. But I mean, unfortunately, there's going to be instances where it's going to be very hard because of these digital divides. Hmm.
Celeste, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for helping us understand your work into researching how patients interact online with their doctors and also social media use during these, you know, pandemic days. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Certainly. Celeste Campos Castillo is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we've been talking about her research examining how technologies disrupt the ability of people to manage privacy of others, about how we're talking about COVID-19 on social media, and also how healthcare patients and doctors communicate online. Tourism in the small town of Wisconsin Dells is a $1 billion business. Visitors from across the Midwest go there for water slides and boat tours. But this year, there are fewer visitors. Workers are scarce, and outbreaks have closed down some popular destinations. Rob Mentzer has more.
If there's a skyline in Wisconsin Dells, it's the twists of the water slides poking up into the sky. The town of fewer than 6,000 residents normally hosts more than 4 million tourists each year. There are about half a dozen huge resorts here with sprawling hotels and big water park attractions. But this year, this tourist town is facing massive challenges. As summer winds down, there are still families visiting. Janice Burris brought her kids and grandkids from Illinois to visit the Mount Olympus Water Park. The group of 12 wears masks in common areas of their hotel, but Burris isn't too worried about traveling during the pandemic.
I mean, you get tired after a while just ignoring your family and friends, so we decided, you know what, we're done with that.
Romy Snyder of the Wisconsin Dells Visitors Bureau says the resorts made complex reopening plans, with water parks reducing capacity and requiring temperature checks at their gates.
Businesses were just grateful that there were things they could do to either open or remain open.
The big resorts, though, are just part of the economy here. There are hundreds of small businesses that rely on the big influx of visitors each summer. 17-year-old Bella Hill works at a downtown candy shop. She says while there are fewer customers this year, there are also many fewer workers.
It's up to the local kids kind of this year. We don't have a lot of help, so some businesses, they can't even open.
Wisconsin Dells relies on foreign workers who come to the U.S. on student exchange visas. This year, because of the pandemic, many countries wouldn't allow workers to travel. In a normal summer, the Dells has about 3,600 guest workers. This year, there were 360. The students face increased risks because many live in densely packed dormitories. In April, an outbreak at one of the dorms required 190 to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Bella Hill says some downtown shops are so understaffed that the workers at competing stores have to run over and cover each other's breaks. She wears a mask at work, but she says not all of her customers do.
The amount of people that come into the store every day, like, we're exposed to a lot, and a lot of times they are not always cautious of the workers.
And there have been outbreaks. In late July, the general manager of Noah's Ark, which bills itself as America's largest water park, was fired after he wrote an email to health officials calling COVID-19 the, quote, phantom China virus and objecting to a proposed mask mandate. Just 2 weeks later, the park closed after two employees tested positive. They've announced that they won't reopen this year. Tim Lothar is the county health officer. He worked with resorts and other businesses to craft safety recommendations. He says it doesn't make sense to see public health as in opposition with business.
If people were to fully institute the public health recommendations, that we could get these businesses open and keep them open so that people would have the confidence to go in, feel safe and protected, and take advantage of the services that they provide. We have to get to that point, or this is just not going to end.
Tourism here in June was down about 40% from the previous year, though it picked up in July. But visits are expected to drop off again at the end of this month and in the fall, when most of the business in Wisconsin Dells comes from conventions. Most of those have been canceled or postponed until 2021. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Protests against racial injustice erupted here in Wisconsin after Kenosha police shot a black man. Coming up next, our guest explains what's happened so far and how the outcry is part of a broader movement against police brutality here in Wisconsin and in beyond. Thanks for being with us this morning.